You're listening to the Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Get ready to be inspired as we explore provocative topics surrounding innovative technologies and ideas with top industry professionals as we help to positively disrupt healthcare. At Impetus Digital, we believe that everything starts with a thought as we aspire to act as the bridge to ignite these courageous conversations, both through our Insight platform and through these fireside chats. Let's get started with your host, Natalie Eden, Managing Director and co-owner of Impetus Digital, an all-in-one virtual collaboration solution for online meetings, events, and advisory boards.
Hi, everybody. My name is Natalie Eden, and I'm the CEO and co-founder with Impetus Digital. If you're not familiar with Impetus, we offer numerous cutting-edge synchronous and asynchronous virtual collaboration and communication tools for life science companies. We help them virtualize everything from their advisory boards, investigator meetings, medical education events. And since then, we've also launched something called Insight Events for large congresses, conferences, sales meetings, et cetera, hackathons, and all sorts of other things. But at Impetus, what's really important here is we really believe that everything starts with a great conversation. And our online collaboration platform is the perfect place for not only just starting these conversations, but also for continuously building on them and creating new and generating new ideas and insights that will be generated over time. So not just throwing everything to the wall and hope something sticks, but over time as we build authentic relationships with people involved in the process. So having these big, hairy, audacious conversations with the provocateurs, the leading edge thinkers, the digital thinkers, we can really start to collectively work to positively disrupt healthcare. So with all that said, the idea behind this webinar series is to start this conversation. And I'm really excited to have one of these provocateurs. This is Dr. Oscar Saguardo. Dr. Oscar Saguardo is a physician. He's also an immunologist and a molecular biologist. He has extensive global leadership experience in clinical research and development, translational medicine, business development, and medical affairs. He received his PhD from the University of Würzburg in Germany and an MD degree from the University of Salamanca in Spain. So I won't be talking in Spanish today, but I'm sure that if you ask him nicely, he will with you. Currently the chief medical officer at ASC Therapeutics, he is a biopharmaceutical industry veteran with global experience, including as CMO at Symvivo Corporation, as well as Myriad Genetics Crescendo. He was the vice president of clinical development and medical affairs at Becton Dickinson Biosciences and global medical head at AbbVie as well as Abbott. So if that's not a resume to write home about, I don't know what would be. He is also a consulting medical officer and mentor for several companies, a tenured professor of immunology at the University of Lyon in Spain, and the author or co-author of over 100 peer-reviewed publications. So welcome, Dr. Saguardo. So happy to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Natalie. I'm really excited to be here. I like to hear the word provocateur. I don't think I've heard that very often, but I would like to tell you that, yes, we are in a very disruptive environment. I'm really happy to be here with you today.
Beautiful. And what an incredible career trajectory. I guess just, you know, maybe starting off, did you always know you wanted to go into medicine? And really from there, how did you ended up getting into pharma and then going from big pharma to little pharma? So tell us a little bit about the amazing road that you've been on.
I don't know if it's amazing. I think everyone has several opportunities in life. And I remember when I was maybe 8 years old, my granddad told me, if you want to get into any kind of job where you will never be hungry, try to be a medical doctor. So it stuck here, and that's why I decided. I'm not a medical doctor as such anymore. I don't see patients anymore, no house calls. But yes, I started working in neuroscience That's where I worked and moved to neuroimmunology, then immunology, then molecular biology. And at some point I decided to go into the industry. And that's in, that was 1993 where I joined Abbott. At that time they have something called ligase chain reaction, which was very similar to PCR, but it disappeared. It's like this video format wars. And I stayed with Abbott and AbbVie for about 15 years. So that's a big pharma. Right now, if you put together AbbVie and Abbott labs, probably there are about 200,000 people in both organizations because they split. Then I moved to Becton Dickinson. And at some point when because I came here to the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, I started seeing all my neighbors saying, okay, wow, there is so much going on in technology and in so many opportunities to start with a very small company and move it forward. So that's what I started to do. And in 2012, I joined Myriad Genetics with a company that originally was Crescendo Bioscience, now is Myriad Autoimmune. And I started moving from there and I never looked back. Now we are a very small emerging biotech, but working in very exciting areas. And again, that's something that you see depending on where you are, your environment, opportunities. And I can tell you, the more I go into these small biotechs and start understanding how they work, the more I see how we're bringing a lot of value to all these big pharmaceutical companies that, by the way, are acquiring these companies nonstop, and also value to patients.
Beautiful. So here you are at ASC Therapeutics. So it's kind of like a biotech, flourishing, kind of startup environment where things are moving quickly, et cetera. And you are working on some very exciting new technology. So just like we're seeing this evolution and this digitization and revolution of all things tech, the same thing is similarly happening in the biotech pharmaceutical space. So maybe we can start off with one of the platforms that your company is really excelling at and pioneering and leading in, which is really the gene editing platform. What you're really doing around optimizing CRISPR-Cas and really the idea around the target gene. Can you talk a little bit about that to a little bit more of a lay audience here?
Sure. One of the reasons I joined ASC Therapeutics is that this is a company founded in 2008, and it was a kind of offshoot from Stanford University. They acquired or they developed together a gene editing technology at the time called Target, which is still used in animal models, and we are working on potentially bringing it to human diseases. And the company decided at some point, from being a life sciences company, again, 2008, it was called Applied Stem Cells, still called that because we divested the ASC Therapeutics company. It was even last year, so I joined to the previous life sciences company. So I like the fact that indeed, as you were saying, we were working with cutting edge technology, even in 2008, where gene editing was not as it is what it is today. And while deciding to go into drug therapeutics, we acquire also we license CRISPR from our neighbors in Berkeley, almost down the street. I'm in Milpitas, north of San Jose. So when we decided that, we started looking into monogenic diseases, where it was clearly easy to make a gene editing and ensuring that you could achieve an improvement of these patients. And we looked into hemophilia A, hemophilia B. We have started with hemophilia A, and this is a monogenic disease. So this affects exclusively males. It's a defect in a gene in the X chromosome. And this is the gene that produces the clotting factor 8. So if you miss that clotting factor 8, you're not able to clot, and you can have a lot of bleeding difficulties. So that was the reason. So right now we are fully engaged in developing CRISPR therapeutics, CRISPR therapy for hemophilia A.
So for the general person listening to this, many of us have gone to school and listened and learned about some of the old ways that they taught genetics with Mendelian genetics, and you know, certain things are sort of stomped and stamped, and this is, you know, you have these genetics and you're going to express them, genotypically in a certain way, and we kind of knew the difference between genotype and phenotype. But how do we sort of explain this idea of clipping things out and replacing them and completely modifying the way somebody expresses things? Like, how does this science of all of this transcend what we have traditionally learned about genetics?
So let me go a little bit back in time. About 20 years ago, and I think we had a kind of celebration recently, the human genome was totally sequenced. And at that time, we were able to sequence about 1,000 base pairs per day. That's what we are able to sequence today per second. So the amount of data that we are receiving, we have from the human genome is tremendous. And what this means is that we are able to identify certain diseases that really depend exclusively on one gene. And this is not so common. So there are about 5,000 diseases that are monogenic. That means that one single gene, if there is a problem with that gene, indeed that leads to a disease. And this is those rare diseases, monogenic diseases. Now, there are about another 100,000 genes that are associated to many diseases. These are multigenic diseases, and they're very difficult to treat even with genomic medicine, let's call it that way. Now, when we as kind of the industry and science and academia started working on this type of diseases, there was also the idea of replacing genes, as you mentioned. So you take that gene that has any kind of defect, any kind of mutation. And by the way, for instance, in hemophilia A, there are many different mutations, but at the end of the day, with the same result, there is no production of factor VIII. And the industry started working on that. And there are several big companies, Pfizer, working with Sangamo. There is also Bayer. There is Roche with Spark. There is BioMarin. They're all working on replacing this factor VIII gene, because although the gene is there, it is really not working properly. And there are two ways to make this replacement. One of them is through gene editing, which is practically leaving that gene that is not functional, you don't need to touch it, and adding to the genome the new gene, which you have provided through different methodologies. And that gene is going to start producing factor VIII. This is the one way to do that. And this is gene editing, because you are integrating the gene into the genome of the individual. That means that even small children with hemophilia A will be able in the future to produce factor VIII, even though the place where we do this, all this gene editing is the liver, and specifically a cell called the hepatocyte. So the hepatocyte is going to start producing this factor VIII. There is a different methodology, which is called generally gene therapy. And in this case, we are not integrating the gene into the genome. We are putting it around the nucleus of the cell, but it still produces factor VIII. And the latter technology is the one that all these companies that I mentioned are working on. We're working on both approaches, gene therapy and gene editing. And with gene therapy, we are about to start a phase one clinical trial. And in both cases, which is interesting, and this is probably what the difference is, the way we work versus others, we are using a replacement gene that has certain characteristics that are different to anything else that is right now in the market. It's a recombinant factor VIII with 9% of sequences that increase synthesis and secretion from the hepatocyte.
This is go ahead.
No, I'm only saying that I'm trying to go slow.
Yeah, no, and it's very helpful, and it's very logical, and there's just so many exciting things associated with this. Another thing that's interesting and exciting with ASC therapeutics is the other focus around stem cell therapy. So we hear a lot about stem cells as it relates to cancer and the regeneration, if you will, of brand new cells from these really infantile types of cells. I know you're working on things like the pluripotent, the mesenchymal, other sorts of, you know, allogeneic deciduous stromal cells or the DSCs, and all sorts of other things for immunomediated diseases. Tell us what's interesting and special about this new line of therapeutics and new lines of science.
Okay, we're switching gears completely, but there is also a convergence on both platforms. So the gene editing, gene therapy platform and the stem cell platform. As I mentioned before, we are a life sciences company with a lot of experience in 2008 in stem cells, practically line production, supporting other biopharmaceutical companies. And at some point we decided, okay, let's leverage this experience with any type of cells that are going to be able to be off the shelf, which is very important because when we in general think about the stem cells, in order to avoid any kind of immune response and rejection, what you do is that you use the cells from the individual. So you practically use the so-called autologous type of therapies where you take those cells, you manipulate them, and you give them back to the patient. That's, for instance, what happens with the big explosion on the so-called CAR Ts, which are lymphocytes from the individual that are manipulated, that you change some you add or provide some molecules that are able to make these lymphocytes go into certain places, and they are extremely helpful for several leukemias and lymphomas. Now, what we are doing and others are doing too is taking certain cells and use them off the shelf. That means that you don't need to take any cells from the patient. These are cells that are going to be provided to the individual, and the individual is going to respond independently of their immune system. And the cells that we use are called DSCs, which is the deciduous stromal cells, which are a type of stem cells that occur in all pregnant women when they have the placenta. And the placenta is a protection for the fetus. So these cells are in the placenta, and they are immunoregulating the immune system so that the 50% of the genes and phenotypic characteristics of the fetus that are from the father are not rejected by the immune system of the woman. So these cells are the ones that we have characterized, isolated, expanded, and we are about to start also a phase 1 clinical trial. These cells were in license from Karolinska Institute in Sweden. And the convergence of both is that because of our experience on cell lines, we will generate from these right now stem cell from pregnant women from the placenta, DSCs, we're going to generate master cell lines that we will be able also to manipulate genetically because of our experience on gene editing and gene therapy, and ensure that we use them for different types of disease conditions.
Fascinating. And we truly are, when we think about the confluence of forces that have transcended or you know, landed on our doorstep about this time last year, with everything from social unrest, economic upheaval, the social contagion, and everything just kind of flew on. We're kind of on this momentum chain that's happened where everything has just been accelerated, technological innovation and biological innovation. We're suddenly at this precipice where we've almost invited the opportunity for us to quote unquote act like God. The book written by Yuval Harari, Homo Deus. What does this say about this? When you have individuals come to the scientists and say, you're playing God, what's the, you know, there's a bioethical issue here. You can't fool around with the secret code that God gave us. Do you get into those conversations, and what do you do around those kinds of naysayers?
Absolutely. This is tremendously important. I think the scientific and biopharmaceutical community is tremendously engaged in that conversation. We all know that there are risks. We also know that we have the responsibility to ensure that the patients that receive these therapies are going to be safe, and that there are going to be no implications for even when they have kids or in general for the population. That's why there was all this big discussion led by those that were involved in the development of gene editing about doing everything you can to avoid germline gene editing, which means ensuring that you are not going to have any change with the gametes that are going to be impregnating and leading to a new life. That's what unfortunately happened in China. You probably heard about that situation a few years ago. And the scientist that was trained here in the US is now in jail. So we all know what are the limits. There are a number of conferences where all this is very well discussed. And we know what are our limits. Now, you touched a very important point, which is safety. So I've been working in medical in the industry, in clinics, in academia. And when I hear my title of chief medical officer, I am the one in my company, and if possible with others, that really takes care about the safety of the patients. Any patient that is going into our clinical trials or in the future, our commercial drug. So that's my responsibility. So I'm working on that all day. And I think that the entire population, patients, anyone in the industry can feel comfortable that we have all the mechanism to protect patients. And that's top priority for the industry.
We're in this interesting predicament as a society, though, in the scientific field. Traditionally, we have been faced with long periods of time where organizations like the FDA, Health Canada, NICE have taken an exorbitant period of time for reviewing of files of data. And then there's another exorbitant period of time before it's approved and there's market access, and on the list goes. Suddenly, COVID-19 happens. And through the pandemic, we have seen an unprecedented trajectory, if you will, of acceptance, approvals at a rate that we've never seen before. Because of that, there's a certain level of distrust based on previous habits and previous thinking and modes of belief systems, that it's only within that period of time and that duration and that level of methodical scrutiny that something could be deemed safe, that one would require a product to be available for 19, 20 years before we could use the word safety. How do you counter those opinions? Has it changed since COVID-19? Is the general public much more open to what safety means and how long it takes to deem a product safe?
So the key is for us as an industry is what the regulators tell us that they are doing. And what I can tell you is that there is this accelerated path of EUA, Emergency Use Authorization, which has been used for the COVID vaccines. And the majority or all the vaccines right now are under this path. And this makes sense. Obviously, we know it works. And this is part of the revolution taking place because many of the biotechnologies used by these RNA and DNA revolution are also used and have been used for many years for gene therapy and gene editing. So some of the what we call delivery systems, which are adenoviruses and RNA and RNA interference or RNA production are used also by our industry. So now, besides this emergency use authorization that you're seeing on the FDA maintains their safety mechanism as strong as they have been always, even more now. So I can tell you that in my industry, in my specific disease modality and therapeutic modality and disease target, hemophilia A, two of our, let's say, competitors have got a clinical hold, meaning that a company working on hemophilia B had the trial stopped, and another one was asked to not even file and wait 2 years to provide more data. So I don't think that there is any relaxation of the safety mechanisms that are in place. And obviously for someone that is like our company that we are about to start a phase one clinical trial, this is an advantage because we are learning, we know what we shouldn't do. And we are taking different approaches, especially in the realm of applying multiomics and big data analytics in this space.
With COVID-19, I have seen an incredible amount of dialogue and discourse on science and medicine I've never seen in the layperson's media. Newscasters talking about mechanisms of action. We're talking about all sorts of things and positioning and messaging from pharmaceutical companies I've never seen before. Are we at a time and place now where the pharma industry is being positioned in a really, really positive way where it has not been in many decades? It's almost been considered the black partner, the bad guy, the people that are just trying to nab. Is this going to change the trajectory, if you will, of clinical trials, people wanting to get into science? And is this going to be increasing enrollments in studies like your company is offering?
Yes, definitely there is a revolution going on. But this is not something that happens out of the blue. This has been a very, very steady development. When we hear about companies like Moderna or BioNTech in Germany, these are companies that have been working on RNA and mRNA and production of vaccines and several other type of ways to regulate the genomic output for many, many years. And the same, the first time that a patient was treated with gene therapy was in about 30 years ago by the NIH. So this is not new. It's simply that it's now getting to a point where many companies are working in this space. And we also see that advanced biologic therapies possess the intrinsic benefit of being precise tools for manipulating human biology. But this only happens with diseases where we have a clear pathophysiology. So again, this is not going to be applicable for many chronic diseases. Now, this is also important because what is happening, and that's why we are hearing so much about this, is that big pharma is moving into this space, has been doing that for the past several years. And they is mostly because they know that this is an investment in the future. It's going to take time. Now, the type of diseases that we are treating right now, that we are targeting, are rare diseases. The majority of them are monogenic diseases. I was working with AveXis on spinal muscular atrophy, and it's again one single gene, one single approach with a type of virus, and being able to practically change totally the trajectory or the trajectory of children or kids that were going to die at about 1 year old, and some of them are now 5 and 10 years old. So we're changing all these diseases, and big companies, Novartis acquired AveXis by $7 billion. So they know that although there is limited and the number of patients that can be treated is relatively small, they know that this is a train that already left the station and everyone needs to get in. And every company needs to be in that type of technology. Now, is that going to change the way treatments are delivered in the day-to-day practice of practitioner in the field with people with all these chronic diseases? It's not. So I hope that what is going to happen is that the cost of the regular treatments for all individuals should go down. I think it's too high. I agree with that, and many of us do. But there are also this kind of trend on looking into human biology and the future of medicine that everyone needs to be involved in.
So you're absolutely right. I mean, the new focus areas gone away from the big blockbuster chronic syndrome issues very much into the oncologic, rare disease, gene-focused types of therapies. A critic may say, because that's kind of where the big money is. Having said that, it does require a lot of precision thinking and design, and a lot of work goes into this, obviously. Now, one of the key pieces to this also has to do with this concept around precision medicine. It's almost like Uber medicine, almost an N equals one. These are so rare and so few that we have to cherry pick these diamonds in the rough. And so we're seeing a lot more around diagnostics and surrogate biomarkers, and hearing a lot more since COVID-19 of liquid biopsies, leveraging other kinds of mechanics and mechanisms and tools for things like patient recorded outcomes and also just diagnostics. Can you speak a little bit about the evolution of precision medicine as it applies to ASC and really around these precise medicines in general?
Yeah, you know, I had the opportunity to learn clinical development of biologics in the 2000s while working with the Humira team at AbbVie. At that time, anti-TNF and immunomodulatory cytokine was a blockbuster with no need for selecting or monitoring patients. So there was no need for biomarkers. Through my work over the last decade focusing on gene and cell therapy programs, especially in rare diseases, I've realized how critical it is to apply all this knowledge about how to select patients and how to monitor patients through biomarkers that really is going to help us have this kind of targeted, precision, personalized medicine. There's no doubt that this is the future. Now, it's going to take some time because I can give you an example on hemophilia A, the way we're doing. I mentioned a moment ago that we have a different type of, it's called transgene, which is this factor VIII gene that we provide to the patients to start producing factor VIII. So when we provide this gene and put that around the nucleus with a, it's called a promoter, and start producing factor VIII, we're forcing the hepatocyte to do something that is not used to do, which is producing that type of protein. Although the hepatocyte is a chemical factory, it's a biofactory that produces hundreds and hundreds of different proteins. But we need to see how is the hepatocyte in that single patient that receives our gene therapy or gene editing. Because if that patient has any kind of predetermined disease, it could be any kind of fibrosis, which is due to alcohol or non-alcoholic hepatitis, or because this patient had any kind of infection, viral infection, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, this hepatocyte is not going to be able to produce factor VIII as another patient that is young and has a very healthy liver. So we need to identify and select patients that we're going to characterize those cells. We're going to look into functional ways to see how they are responding to our therapy. And also we're going to monitor them once they get the therapy. We just incorporated in our phase one clinical trial a request from the FDA, which is that this patient should get ultrasound every 6 months for 10 years. So why is that? Because some patients seem to potentially develop any kind of dysfunction on the liver. So you see, and this is imaging, but at the end of the day, it's another type of biomarker. We have a number of tests and besides the liver enzymes and so on, where we are going to be able to define how these patients are doing. And we're collaborating, for instance, with Siemens, with a number of biomarkers in development. And they are also going to we're going to collaborate on looking how these patients respond. So the use of biomarkers is absolutely critical in the way we combine all these new learnings on human biology and the way these patients are selected and they are monitored.
Fascinating. We're in a really, really interesting time in the world. I think we've never seen a time where healthcare has been more of an urgent issue of, it has been politicized in so many dimensions and in so many ways as we've have since COVID-19. When we talk about really important products like gene editing, stem cells, and all sorts of things in between with the Uber precision medicine diagnostics that we're discussing, these are all very expensive entities. And as we think about progress, we can't help but think that the cost of healthcare is going to continue to increase over time. So in the present way that we have incorporated a certain percentage of healthcare costs as a percentage of the GDP and all these sorts of things, do you foresee this being a completely different business model in the future? If this is going to go beyond our imagination, making sure that everybody who is eligible to have these kinds of therapies will have access, what needs to happen in a systems innovation thinking methodology for us to completely reimagine what this is going to look like and how these diagnostics and how these drugs, chemicals, and other sorts of software as a medical device are going to get paid for in the future?
That's also a big topic in the industry. And imagine that, for instance, that the type of therapy that we are generating, the first patient that is going to enter in our clinical trials, the treatment that he or she is going to take is going to cost about $1 million. One single dose, because it's one and done. They receive this drug, this infusion, and they don't need probably factory replacement ever. Now, but if you think about that, these patients need to go to the clinic weekly. They need replacement therapy, and this is for life. So we are going to change totally the dynamic of certain patients that had a chronic disease, and they're going to practically get rid of it. It's one and done. So these $1 million plus whatever, obviously, way we recoup all the investment, R&D, and our investors and so on, is going to have a very high cost. But this is also related to the advantage and the savings that this patient is going to have over time. And this is the way these kind of therapies are positioned. This therapy for Zolgensma, for SMA that now is run by Novartis, is a $2 million drug. But you have a kid that you know is going to die around 1 year old, or is going to have a normal life and be a normal individual. Is $2 million worthwhile? Now, it is. It's clear. Now, the question is who pays for it? And for that, I am not going to use, but I'm going to say that word, Medicare for all, politically charged. But you know, I'm from Europe. I spend the majority of my life in Germany and Spain, and this is the way it works in Europe. There is a Medicare for all there. So the and Zolgensma is reimbursed by the healthcare systems there everywhere. So they see that there is an advantage there instead of having a kid that is going to also produce a lot of pain in the family and loss of productivity. So that's the way medicine and healthcare should work. It should be really a right for everyone. And we're seeing that happening right now. So right now we have diagnostics, treatments, and all type of therapies for COVID being paid for everyone in the United States. So this is the first step. It's happening already. So, and we're going to see in many other diseases that is much more effective for the country to do something like that and have a universal healthcare system than these bits and pieces or something mixed, combined, which is what they have in Germany, where they have private insurance for some people that want some elevated type of care, but a basic insurance for everyone in Germany.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic that I'm sure we will be having for many years to come. And the interesting thing, and again, Canada has this so-called universal healthcare as well. I mean, how universal is a bit controversial, but the idea here is that we are all change agents. And I'm a really big proponent of innovation systems thinking and change, that at the end of the day, we can't just take a look at small little bits and pieces. This has to be a holistic oversight and overview to change it. And ultimately, it comes down to incentivization. How does the money flow? So part of this is change management. We've created entire legacy infrastructure systems that surrounds the sickness thinking in the healthcare industry. And what we're talking about is a mega shift to the wellness piece. So we're really talking about taking the chronic disease management and transporting it into a place almost like prevention. You're still disease, treating a disease, but you're preventing the chronic version of what's going to cost the system X amount associated with metabolic syndrome and all sorts of other things. So you're really just shifting the cost, and that requires a shift of thinking, and that potentially could create a lot of upheaval with the legacy systems that have been set up. How do you propose that you, other stakeholders, the healthcare continuum works as an ecosystem to change that belief system?
I must say that you touched in an area that is very, very close to my heart, which is preventive medicine. And this is holistic medicine. So we are in the Western world and we are totally ignoring what happened during thousands and thousands of years in India, in China, in the entire Asia, where they were developing all these techniques or practices. And this is Chinese medicine, this is Ayurvedic medicine, that really are focused exclusively or mostly on prevention. And this is something that is missing here. I must say I've written a book, sorry for making some commercial here, but if you go to Amazon, you're going to see a book talking about one of these practices that is called mindful framing, about how to use your mind to connect and control your body. We all need to think about that. We all need to change the way the Western civilization has been moving away from this prevention and just having a lifestyle that is very, very negative and producing the majority of these chronic diseases. So it's alcohol, it's drugs, it's lack of exercise, it's anxiety, it's a number of things that are happening that are leading us to a very sick population. And this is completely different, obviously, from these rare diseases where you cannot do anything about that. But these chronic diseases, we can do a lot. And I would like really to ensure that there is a change. And I'm personally supporting that change. And I'm bringing some of this knowledge from Eastern medicine into Western. So I'm part of it.
I love that you brought that up. And I think it's so timely and so important also with the work that ASC Therapeutics is delivering through gene editing, because what it means and says to us is we're not just robots. We're not just genetic code. There's a concept around epigenetics. There's a concept around learned optimism. Somebody named Marty Seligman wrote that in Positive Psychology in the 70s. And then, of course, all the framework around, you know, manifestation and belief and changing the phenotypic, you know, I guess, manifestation of what your genes are saying. So I'd love to get a little bit more on your personal frame on that mindful framing of how does the spiritual or the woo-woo actually translate? Because I do believe that the two meet. And it has a scientific translation, and one can call it epigenetics. How do the two relate?
So don't ask me to try to explain why I'm so weird. And I talk about voodoo medicine, and at the same time, I'm talking about the most advanced biologic therapies in the space. It happened. So when I was a young man, I learned acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine. I got interested in Ayurvedic medicine. And then I have a personal situation that led me to what is called a high functioning anxiety. And I needed to deal with that. There is no genetic therapy for that. There is no treatment. You can go back into medication, or you can try to get rid of it or work on that, regulating your anxiety and the way you function as an individual. And I developed my own methodology, and I published it, and it has been an Amazon bestseller. I've also created a nonprofit institute helping people to do what I call Neo-Chi lifestyle. And again, chronic therapies and people that have all kind of chronic diseases driven by lifestyle have no treatment. They can be ameliorated, but they cannot be cured. But genetic therapies in the future will be cured, many of them. But so that's why we need to do something. And it's prevention. It's something that you need time. You need to spend time on yourself. So sorry for bringing a topic that is off topic here.
I don't really think it is. I'm a true believer that there is a union between the non-scientific and the scientific, and they meet in the singularity. So I'm a big fan of Ray Kurzweil and all those things, you know, Eric Topol, and just there's a happy place where they all kind of meld. So as we sort of think about this idea of the gene editing and stem cells and kind of the reinvention of the human, do you see the day where we're going to be creating cells from, you know, other kinds of material? Are they all going to be biologic? Do you have a perspective on that never-ending conversation about what it means to be human, what it means to have consciousness? Is it somebody who has genes? Can you build code and insert it into an, automaton, and it's made out of silicon? What is your philosophical view on that?
Unfortunately, it's not good. So I think that we will have to have some guardrails here. So people will be able to do things that are a little bit science fiction right now. But I hope that we will be able to control all these things. We all know synthetic biology is already there, so you're practical. And I just read a few days ago that they cloned a ferret or something that was about this to disappear. We all know that organs will be grown in pigs, and we will be able to transplant those organs. All this is going to happen. Now, all that has not any impact on human biology or human consciousness. I think that these are areas that are massive developments in medicine or biomedicine, and there is no way to stop it. So that's going to happen. Now, we will need, again, a very strong ethical bodies that are going to control, and it's going to happen. Nowadays, no one can do anything without being practically assessed what they are doing. There are CCTVs everywhere, and the internet is tracking all our digital footprints. So no one is going to be able to do anything that is untowards.
Yeah, it is a very interesting world, and it's everybody's version of progress. Some people may see it differently, but I think universally it's always kind of going in the forward direction. As we're thinking about vaccines, which is on the hearts and minds of everybody around us, where does gene editing, gene sequencing fit into this? Are we going to start seeing vaccines being developed in this way? Are we going to see faster, more virulent discovery, invention, trials in situ, use of algorithms and the development of these things? What do you sort of see as being some of the future of what is transpiring in science?
Yeah, I'm very lucky that because I'm into the stem cell space and I'm a cell biologist, but what happens when you're an immunologist, you're a cell biologist, protein biologist, and molecular biologist at the same time. So over the past year, I've been attending in a first weekly, now bi-weekly basis to a webinar, a Zoom call with the top scientists in the world working with cells and COVID. And among the people that have been presenting is everything related to RNA vaccines, DNA vaccines, and so on. And everyone at that call is absolutely flabbergasted by the speed of the delivery of these vaccines. And this is just an example of what happens when you are in real need. So we were able to do in 9 months what people thought could take 9 years. That's the reality. So the capacity is there, the mind power is already there, and we will be able to see more improvements. But I think that the basics, the RNA vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, the DNA vaccines, the basics are already there. And it's just about improving the production. By the way, is a big issue. Manufacturing is something that people don't think about, but we were lucky that Pfizer decided to work together with BioNTech in Germany, and they were able to mass produce the vaccine. But other companies, Moderna is also working with another company that usually works with gene therapy companies, Lonza, and that's the way it works. So we're learning in a daily basis, and the progress is going to be phenomenal. We were able to sequence the COVID virus in the first weeks after it was detected, and now we are doing the same with all the variants. So it's a kind of mix of personalized medicine, precision therapies. This is the infrastructure is in place, and we're not only going to see tremendous progress day in and day out.
We were talking a little bit earlier around the impact of and the shift of the healthcare system from the sickness mentality to the wellness frontier. Part of this also has to do with the food that we eat. When we think about gene editing, a lot of people's minds immediately go to GMOs, genetically modified foods. We start thinking about these genetic foods like super meats and milk without cows. And, you know, how do we, you know, reduce world hunger and those sorts of things? What's your thoughts on some of the negativity, you know, these people that would be considered anti-vaxxers or naysayers who have really ethical and other sorts of arguments against progress in science?
So again, I'm so deep inside science and ethics and safety. And as I mentioned, I look always into what is safe for my patients to take, the patients that go in clinical trials at this point, that I have absolutely no concern about that. I understand that there are people that read an article and they are very nervous, and I am lucky. I understand the basics. I understand everything. And what I can tell you is that I feel extraordinarily comfortable. And I know that there is gene modified everything now in terms of nutrition. And there is also nutrigenomics, where you see also how the patients respond to the certain type of therapies. So for instance, something that, again, about myself, I enjoyed bread and breaded stuff all my life until about 5-10 years ago, when I started noticing that it was not working so well. With age, you start having certain kind of intolerance to certain type of food, and I'm gluten free now, so I'm doing much better. So I feel much better than 10 or 15 years ago until I discovered that. So you see, this is. And I didn't do any test. I simply just did a kind of trial and error. And I'm sure that many people have the same with other type of foods or things they are doing. I cannot almost drink alcohol now also, because I see that it's not good for me. And okay, I was drinking my wine every night until about 5 years ago. Now I can't, I don't. So these are things that everyone needs to be responsible for themselves. I think there is also a problem here, that we are all expecting someone to hold our hand and tell us what to do. That's not possible. If you read and you start thinking that there is something that you don't like, don't do it. Just what I would say is that don't try to tell other people what to do. if wearing masks or taking a vaccine. Do it yourself. Let others do whatever they want.
Just on that last note, I'd love to get your final perspective on something that's been going on in the market. And again, small companies like yours, you know, there's a financialization to it. We've seen a lot going on in the markets recently with GameStop and all the short squeeze that happened, and tons of money getting pumped in with retail investors, which ultimately has some effect on companies like ASC Therapeutics. And so with the up and down of this in the swing of the stocks, how do you prevent the company from getting distracted so that you focus on the science and keep doing what you're doing?
So the market is very efficient. That's the first thing I'm going to say. GameStop and AMC went down from their peaks, and they are now in the real life back. Now, so it's going to happen. Everyone is going to invest in companies or in assets that are going to have any value for the future. And that refers also, I don't know, cryptos or whatever. So I follow the market very, very closely. We are in a fundraising stage right now. So I'm not concerned about all that. These are phases. The stock market has been around for 150 years and it has been working efficiently. And we have also enough people in regulatory bodies looking into all these things. Again, I'm not concerned at all. All this is okay. And they're some situations that resolve by themselves.
And ASC Therapeutics will continue on, keeping on. So if you were to say new partnerships, new investors, what would ASC be looking for in terms of people wanting to plug and play and do some work with? What would you be saying to people who are watching now?
So again, we are looking for venture capitalists that are interested in supporting our programs. And we're also looking into partnerships with large or medium-sized biopharmaceutical companies. Now, the way those are structured, the term sheet and so on, it depends, but this is standard. So I can tell you there are many companies to choose, and everyone can do that at any time point, but we are one of them. And we have our story. And thank you so much, by the way, Natalie, for giving me the opportunity to speak with you and your audience here.
Absolutely. And so for anybody who's interested, we are going to leave Dr. Oscar Suguardo's LinkedIn and other contact information in the show notes. So please look for that if you're interested in contacting or partnering. Please check out impetusdigital.com. We have these kinds of conversations asynchronously and synchronously through our virtual collaboration platforms. If you're interested in having these discussions, coming up with consensus documents, beyond the pill conversations, this is precisely what we do. Please like or subscribe so other people can find our information. We appreciate everybody's time today. Thank you, Dr. Suguardo. This was an outstanding conversation. Wishing everybody a great day ahead.
Thank you for listening to this Healthcare Goes Digital podcast. Impetus Digital are the business-to-business advisory board experts and provide virtual collaboration solutions for meetings, events, and projects worldwide. Visit us at impetusdigital.com to find out more and subscribe to our LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube to stay up to date about other upcoming inspiring conversations.